This program was first broadcast in September of last year.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Some 40 million miles of roadways encircle the earth, yet we tend to regard them only as infrastructure for human convenience. While roads are so ubiquitous, they're practically invisible to us. Wild animals experience them as entirely alien forces of death and disruption. In his new book, Crossings, environmental journalist Ben Goldfarb travels throughout the United States and around the world to investigate how roads have transformed our planet. A million animals are killed by cars each day in the U.S. alone. But as the new science of road ecology shows, the harms of highways extend far beyond roadkill. Creatures from antelope to salmon are losing their ability to migrate in search of food and mates. Invasive plants hitch rides in tire treads. Road salt contaminates lakes and rivers. And the very noise traffic produces chases songbirds from vast swaths of habitat. Ben Goldfarb is author previously of Eager, The Surprising and Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter, winner of the Penn E.O. Wilson Literary Science Writing Award. His writing has appeared in Atlantic, National Geographic, New York Times, and many other publications, and he lives in Colorado. Ben Goldfarb, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot for having me again.
Really enjoyed Eager, and we had another conversation. You were in Cache Valley area, I guess, looking at beavers as well. So
that's right. Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Great to talk to you in this new book. This new book is, I guess, out soon, I think.
Yeah, 1 week from today, September 12th.
Okay, so get ready to rush out and get the book. Well worth the read. It's called Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. So in the introduction there, I mentioned, roadkill, obviously, but many other effects of animals. I was fascinated by how you began the book in your prologue, talking about cliff swallows. So tell me a little bit about cliff swallows.
Yeah, that's really a fascinating case study in how roads can shape nature. So the situation there, probably many listeners have seen cliff swallow nests on the undersides of highway bridges and overpasses, right? These are animals that, build their little mud nests in close proximity to traffic. And, what researchers found over the course of many years of studying cliff swallow roadkill is that first, swallow roadkill has declined over time. And then the reason for that is that they're actually evolving to become less susceptible to roadkill. So their wings are getting shorter. And the reason that's good for avoiding roadkill is that, animals with long wings, long wings are good for flying long straight distances, whereas short wings are good for making lots of tight turns and rolls and avoiding 18-wheelers, basically. So, as these animals have increasingly lived in close proximity to traffic, they've actually evolved to become better at avoiding traffic. Just kind of an amazing example of how roads truly drive natural selection and evolution.
Of course, I said there are other factors beyond roadkill, but I want to quote this from your book. Roadkill, sometime in the 20th century, scientists have written, roadkill surpassed hunting as the leading direct human cause of vertebrate mortality on land.
Yeah, it's truly kind of an astonishing impact. I think that we kind of take it for granted in some ways. We've all seen dead deer and raccoons and squirrels by the side of the road. And, I think that because of the species that we often see dead on the road are common ones, we don't really think about roadkill as being, one of the primary factors that's reducing wildlife populations all over the world and even driving some species toward extinction. Roads they're so ubiquitous in our lives that we kind of they're almost invisible to us. But if you're an elk or a pronghorn or a bobcat, roads are one of the primary forces that's endangering your life and limiting your ability to move throughout your habitat. So roads are certainly profound contributors to biodiversity loss.
I took a little drive yesterday in Cache Valley here, beautiful, kind of on the back roads. And it's apropos to today's discussion. Fortunately, I saw a little dead kitten on the road. I had to swerve to miss some ducks crossing the road. Because we all see it, right? But in large measure, this is kind of invisible to us, right?
I think that's true, yeah. And just but just yesterday too, while you were driving around Cache Valley, I was driving back to Colorado from New Mexico, and came across a prairie rattlesnake, sunning itself on the warm asphalt by the side of the highway, and pulled over to nudge that animal off the road with my fishing rod case. But certainly, I mean, we've all had that experience, and again, I think because we've all had that experience, we tend to ignore that experience. I think that one of the kind of essential ironies of roads is that we associate them with human freedom and mobility, right? All of the great artists and writers and musicians of the 20th century celebrate the open road as again sort of the ultimate symbol of human freedom, from Jack Kerouac to Bruce Springsteen. The mythology of the highway is something we're all kind of steeped in, and I think that as a result, because we associate roads with human freedom, we don't think about them as these forces that really restrict or curtail animal movement.
You're cutting out just a little bit. It's kind of the signal's fading. Okay. I don't know if you can adjust the phone to your face or something to,
Sure. Is that a little better?
It sounds a little better right there, yeah. So, as I mentioned, we began with the swallows and that roads are affecting evolution. So there's some other effects. So you write in the book about there's a fungus that attacks cedar trees. That fungus hitchhikes in the patterns of truck tires. There's a red fire ant which attacks the eyes of elephants. That sounds awful. So they have greatly expanded their range by hitchhiking.
Yeah, absolutely. And roads are certainly these corridors of invasive species movement. We all drive around and see these endless rows of dandelions, along highway sides. Well, dandelions are an invasive species that have followed roads to colonize the entire continent, and there are many examples of that. I mean, one thing that you often see, in national forests especially, is that, all of these weed seeds will basically kind of wedge themselves into the patterns of logging truck tires or, ATV treads, and roads become these sort of dispersal corridors for, invasive thistles and all kinds of other species. So, I think that's one of the fascinating things about roads is that they're not just destroyers of ecosystems. They're also ecosystems in their own right, that have their own kind of unique cast of characters that really benefit from the road. Roads don't just create losers in nature. They also create some winners as well. And, sometimes those winners are those invasive weeds that we might not want spreading across the landscape, but are taking advantage of the transportation infrastructure we've built for them.
You write that, I'm going to quote you here, this is Ben Goldfarb from his book Crossings. If you're a Kerouac reader, you grew up steeped in the dogma that highways represent freedom. If you're a grizzly bear, they might as well be prison walls. So that's another factor. I think that we've heard a bit about this, that, you can trap species, prevent, greatly reduce their habitat.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, anything from, for a grizzly bear, even 6 cars per hour, one car every 10 minutes is enough to prevent them from crossing a road. And certainly that barrier effect of traffic can be even worse than roadkill itself in some ways. There are really terrible examples of migrating herds of mule deer and pronghorn and elk, in places like Wyoming, and certainly this is happening to an extent in Utah as well. That because they of course these animals have to move across large areas to find food throughout the year, and that's especially true in late fall, early winter, right, when they have to get to their winter range, these low elevation valleys, that they can kind of ride out the winter in. And if there's a steady stream of traffic, on I-80 or I-70 that's preventing them from reaching that winter range, there are examples of herds of mule deer and pronghorn starving en masse because they can't get to those critical resources during a really sensitive time of year. You know, and in some ways that barrier effect is even worse than roadkill, right? You could imagine that, a herd of mule deer can survive, a few collisions. But what they can't survive is kind of mass starvation because they can't reach that winter range. So that, it's challenging because, again, we've all seen that dead deer by the side of the road. But, in some ways, it's the animals that aren't crossing the road that are in the most danger.
So you talk about let's talk about road ecology. How did this develop?
Yeah, in some ways it goes back to the 1920s, as cars kind of permeate American society and become increasingly common. There were a handful of biologists, back in the 20s who were increasingly worried about animal-vehicle collisions. The word roadkill didn't actually exist yet. That wasn't coined until the 1940s. But you read all of these studies a century ago, guys driving around places like Iowa and Illinois and, counting all of the dead garter snakes and woodpeckers they saw. So, go back a century and there were people concerned about the toll that cars were taking on wild animals. I mean, the term road ecology itself, the study of how roads shape nature, now that term wasn't coined in English until the 1990s by a landscape ecologist at Harvard named Richard Foreman. And, Richard one day, as he told me, was with a bunch of students in his office, and he was looking at this picture of a forest and, talking about, where the water flowed and, where the people put their houses and, where the animals moved. And then he sort of looked at that road moving right through the center of the image and realized that, while ecologists knew a lot about everything else in that picture, they hadn't really thought a whole lot about the road. And yet the road was, in many ways kind of the dominant factor affecting everything else in that image. So, that notion that roads are sort of central to how ecosystems are formed and structured and how we affect wildlife, that was really Richard Foreman's innovation in the 1990s.
You write that when alien archaeologists exhume the rubble of human civilization, they may conclude our raison d'etre was building roads, which, we can certainly relate to. We'll get into some solutions later, and there are some interesting things happening. But maybe just treat that for a bit. And the fact that in the U.S. we're kind of just getting to the point where we're maintaining, but there's set to be an explosion of road building worldwide.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Here in the U.S., we have the world's largest road network at about 4 million miles. And we are building some new roads, but, a lot of what we do now is just maintain the existing ones. But, that's certainly not the case, in the developing world. Countries like Kenya and Nepal and Bangladesh, are building road networks very rapidly. And, those road networks are critical to human flourishing and lifting people out of poverty, right? I mean, those roads are how farmers get crops to markets and how, kids go to school and how people reach healthcare. Certainly those, the explosion of roads in the developing world, the infrastructure tsunami, as one ecologist has described it, is, again, sort of crucial for human welfare. And yet it's also this potential catastrophe for biodiversity. A lot of those new highways in the developing world are slated to go through critical habitat for tigers and elephants and, all kinds of species that are declining globally. So I think that's really the importance of road ecology in some way is, if some of these new highways are inevitable and even desirable, well, how do we build them in ways that minimize their impacts on all of these critically endangered species that we care about? And road ecology, this science, points us towards some solutions, whether that's avoiding, the most important habitat areas or building wildlife crossings that, allow animals to get from point A to point B. But certainly, we need to think about, where these new roads are going and how they're being built, because, they have the potential to be truly catastrophic for biodiversity on Earth.
You point out that it's not only roadkill and some of the other problems that we're talking about, but kind of writ larger environmental problems, right? Highways are also not only roads to economic development and other positive things, but also roads to, forgive the pun, environmental problems.
Absolutely, yeah. Certainly, I mean, name any sort of environmental problem you can think of, and roads are sort of the leading contributor to it, or certainly they facilitate it or make it possible. One of the chapters of the book is about sort of the history of road building in Brazil. And there, the story of Amazonian highways and all of the little illegal logging roads that spiderweb off of those big highways. I mean, that's the story of the deforestation of the Amazon, right? You can't, you can't get the heavy machinery in and get the logs out unless you have roads to transport, that equipment and material on. Certainly, poaching in many places is facilitated by roads, which allow poachers to, enter these important habitat areas for elephants and rhinoceroses and other species. So, roads, the kind of the dumb pun that, I use in the book is that they're sort of the roots of all evil, R-O-U-T-E-S. They're sort of the human conveyances that make all environmental destruction and exploitation possible.
You also talk about the cars that we drive on those roads, and the emissions. Of course, we know about that. And then that brought up a question. You answered that as I was reading along. What about electric vehicles? That's not an unalloyed good, right? There are some problems with electric vehicles.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, absolutely. The mining boom that's happening now to create EV batteries, to supply lithium and cobalt and other materials is absolutely transforming landscapes. But, I think that more than that, there's sort of this mindset that's somewhat common in the transportation world, I think, that electric vehicles are going to solve the environmental problems of transportation, right? As though the primary problem with transportation from an ecological standpoint is the carbon emissions. And if we can just create cars that don't produce as many carbon emissions, then we've basically solved the problem, through electric vehicles. And, I think that in some ways the point of my book is to say that, look, the carbon emissions are certainly part of the problem, but they're only one part, right? And that, there's roadkill, there's the barrier effect, there's tire particles, which really transform ecosystems and have, killed fish en masse in some places. There are all of these impacts, and, electrifying the vehicle fleet, it might be beneficial from a climate perspective, but, it's not going to do anything for, an elk or a pronghorn or a bobcat, right? And in some ways, it could even make the situation worse for some of those species. I mean, you could imagine that, as it becomes cheaper to drive, which it will, when we're able to just plug in all of our cars, then we're going to drive more. And the impact of that increased driving could be really, really detrimental. In Utah, traffic rates have doubled in the last 25 years, and they show no signs of abating. And certainly that's the case here in Colorado too. EVs are not going to solve that problem. They might even make it worse.
We're in the West, especially we're all familiar with gripping the steering wheel with the white knuckles come dusk, right?
Right.
A deer might dart out, right? And that's kind of brings it into bold relief. Just that interface. Let's take a break, and we'll come back with more with Ben Goldfarb, author of the book Crossings: How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Ben Goldfarb. He is the author, previously, of Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. The current book is called Crossings: How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. Interesting, important book. He says some 40 million miles of roadways encircle the Earth, yet we tend to regard them only as infrastructure for human convenience. And the book is how These roads affect wildlife to the point of even affecting evolution, as we talked about with the swallows. Sven Goldfarb, you say that your own introduction to road ecology came in 2013, the year you embarked on a trip across the continent to write about the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative. This is an ambitious, incredible project. Tell us a little bit about that and then how that got you into road ecology.
Yeah, good question. So Y2Y, or the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative, is basically this big idea to create a sort of connected and protected series of wildlife corridors across the kind of the spine of the continent in the Rocky Mountains. And, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, one giant corridor that animals will use in its entirety, right? It's more like a kind of a series of patchwork areas. Basically the idea being that, you know, these large, wide-ranging animals like elk and caribou and wolves can kind of navigate this landscape, you know, free from death at human hands. And, you know, and certainly dealing with all of the roads in that region is a really important part of that big vision. And one of the highways disrupting wildlife movements within this giant Y2Y corridor is Highway 93, you know, which sort of runs north to south through Montana. And, you know, there in sort of the early 2000s, the Montana Department of Transportation, sort of in partnership with the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, built all of these wildlife crossings to allow elk, moose, grizzly bears, other species to move back and forth across this highway and you know, prevent dangerous collisions with drivers and wild animals. So, you know, when I was writing about this, I had the opportunity to go up on to one of these wildlife overpasses on Highway 93. And that was a decade ago now. And it was just incredibly powerful and interesting and even moving. You know, we do so much you know, to make animals' lives harder on this planet, often, you know, with our sort of ill-placed infrastructure. But here's a case of building this piece of infrastructure, this giant bridge for animals. And I just found that, you know, both very moving in the sense that, you know, here is this kind of wonderful expression of empathy for other species. You know, we spent millions of dollars building this structure just for animals. What a cool, thoughtful, compassionate idea. But I was also kind of fascinated by the intellectual challenge there too. I mean, obviously our infrastructure is so strange and alien and often frightening to other species. How do you build a piece of infrastructure, in this case, a wildlife overpass, that is enticing, you know, to a coyote or a bobcat or even a meadow vole, you know, all of these small animals that have to cross the highway as well. So, you know, that challenge of kind of thinking about the landscape and the built environment from an animal's perspective was just so interesting to me and kind of got me started on this journey.
Speaking of which, I want to read from the book. This is Ben Goldfarb from his book, Crossings. Consider the sensory experience of, say, a fox approaching a highway. The eerie linear clearing that gashes the landscape, the acrid stench of tar and blood, the blinding lights staring from the faces of thundering predators. So, you know, and you're right, is it possible to perceive our world built through non-human eyes?
Right, exactly. You know, I think that those sensory pollutants, you know, the light and the noise, those are things that we often don't think about because, again, you know, traffic is so mundane to us. You know, the sound of traffic is just sort of constantly in our lives, and we basically don't notice it. But, you know, if you're a wild creature, like an owl, for example, you know, that has to listen for the sound of your prey's feet in the grass. Well, you know, the noise pollution created by engines and tires, you know, basically masks that important auditory signal that you need to survive. And, you know, as a result, you're sort of forced to leave that area. So, you know, roads themselves, I mean, they might only be 100 feet wide, and yet this kind of sensory pollution, the noise and the light that's billowing off of them into the environment, you know, can really have very broad, wide impact. And, you know, I think that thinking about those sensory pollutants from an animal's perspective is one of the really important things that, you know, that road ecologists try to do.
I like this passage. I'm going to read this so I get it right. You were in the company, you're driving US 93 in the company of Marcel, is it Heiser? How do you pronounce his name?
Hauser, yeah.
Hauser, he's a Dutch scientist who's relocated to the U.S. And so I'm just going to quote this. Hauser didn't share my. You're saying you're on this bridge, and you were. You know, you say you're in muted awe. You say Hauser didn't share my muted awe. He paced the crossing, pointed out design flaws. He was displeased with the bridge's Spartan landscaping, a few carefully positioned brush piles he suspected would aid mice and voles, and his sight lines were too exposed. His cameras had recently captured a black bear fleeing the headlights of an approaching car. A visual screen would be helpful, he said. Shrubbery and earthen berm might do the trick. It could just be a wooden fence. And Hauser, occurred to me, you say, was attempting to inhabit other beings.
Right. You know, I think that idea that these, you know, these wildlife crossing structures, you know, they're ecosystems in their own right. I think that was the point that Marcel was trying to make there, is that, you know, if animals are going to use these structures and cross them, you know, and go back and forth as we want them to, you know, they have to be appealing or enticing to those animals, you know, and what makes a crossing appealing or enticing, you know, is different for every species, right? That if you're, you know, if you're a little rodent, for example, you know, you might need these piles of rocks and logs and other little micro habitat features that allow you to kind of run from cover to cover as you cross an overpass, right? So that's, again, kind of the challenge of road ecology, is to think about what all of these different species need. You know, another good example of that is pronghorn. You know, antelope are these incredibly fast, far-sighted animals that, you know, that much prefer to be out in the open, you know, so they can escape from predators, you know, using their great speed. So, you know, pronghorn don't want to be in a, you know, a little confined tunnel. They want, you know, a big bridge that, you know, allows them long sight lines across the landscape. So, you know, thinking about how every species in an ecosystem perceives the landscape and wildlife crossings, I think that's another really important aspect of road ecology, is just accounting for the different lifestyles and ecological niches of all of the species that might encounter a road or a wildlife crossing.
Speaking of the scientist, Marcel Hauser, you write about how the Netherlands tackled this problem. He focuses on hedgehogs, at least he did when he was in the Netherlands. Tell me a little bit about this and how, I guess, the whole nation rallied behind this this project of trying to defragment the habitats.
Yeah, you know, the Netherlands is really a leader in road ecology. And, you know, and there, I mean, that's sort of out of necessity. You know, unlike the American West, you know, they don't have huge swaths of public land that furnish good wildlife habitat. You know, it's a very built, urbanized, densely developed country, and as a result, you know, animals have to cross roads constantly. You know, they don't have, you know, they don't have bears and, you know, and other big animals like we do necessarily, but they've got, you know, badgers and hedgehogs and, you know, and polecats and all kinds of other critters. And so there, you know, they built, you know, more than 600 wildlife crossings, you know, to sort of facilitate the movement of all of these little species, and you know, they really have likely more wildlife crossings, you know, per mile of road than any other country in the world, you know, there's certainly a lot that we can learn from, you know, not only the Netherlands but other European countries like Germany and Austria and Switzerland that have built many of these crossings, and you know, and really sort of started this road ecology, wildlife crossing movement, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, you know, and in some ways, I mean, we're still catching up compared to those places, you know, here in the United States. I mean, certainly, you know, we've built a lot of crossings in the last couple of decades, and we're, you know, we're building new ones all the time, which is very exciting. But again, you know, still plenty to learn from our European colleagues.
Oh, maybe we can talk about some more success stories here. You know, is the main solution these crossings? Is that the main thing we want to do?
That's, you know, that's certainly one important one. I mean, I think it's important to remember that the wildlife crossings don't solve all of the problems that the roads create, right? I mean, certainly they help with the animal-vehicle collisions, which is a huge problem, and they help animals you know, migrate from point A to point B and access their habitat. So that's, you know, that's certainly, you know, hugely beneficial. They don't necessarily solve the road noise pollution or the tire particles or the road salt, right? They're not, you know, they're not panaceas for this whole collective suite of problems that roads cause. But, you know, they certainly do a lot of good, you know, by preventing, you know, animal vehicle collisions that are both problematic from a conservation standpoint, but are also really dangerous, right? I mean, something like 200 drivers are killed in deer collisions every year, and, you know, and collisions with large animals cost the American public more than $8 billion a year. So this is a, you know, hugely dangerous, expensive problem, as well as one that's, you know, really detrimental to biodiversity. So, you know, these wildlife crossings with fences that guide animals to the crossings, you know, they tend to pay for themselves really, really rapidly by preventing all of these dangerous deer crashes. And, you know, actually, I mean, Utah is really one of the leaders in this field in a lot of ways. You know, the first wildlife overpass in the United States was built in Utah in 1975 on I-15 for migrating mule deer. And since then, there have been, you know, 50 to 60 crossings built around the state of Utah, along with lots of fencing projects as well. So, you know, Utah is absolutely one of the states that's implementing this solution at the largest scale.
So tell me a little more specificity about these crossings. These can be tunnels, I guess, or, you know, bridges, or I've seen on highways in Utah. Mostly what I've seen is, you know, there's a place for deer and others to go under the highway. But tell me a little bit more about what happens.
Yeah, you know, it really depends on the species and the situation, right? I mean, you know, wildlife crossings can be anything from, you know, big sweeping overpasses for, you know, bears and elk to, you know, little culverts and tunnels for frogs and turtles and salamanders, right? So it all depends on sort of the situation and the species you're trying to address. You know, probably the most famous wildlife crossing in Utah is the overpass at Parley's Summit on I-80, and I bet a lot of listeners have driven under that structure, or, you know, seen the kind of the viral video of all of the different animals crossing it. And that's, you know, that's a really interesting crossing structure in a lot of ways. And that stretch of highway used to be known as Slaughter Row for its, you know, its really high rates of collisions with deer, elk, moose, even mountain lions. And, you know, in that case, you know, UDOT built a wildlife overpass. It was completed in 2018, and it was a very interesting structure. You know, it's a very long, skinny bridge. It's 320 feet long and only 50 feet wide or so. And, you know, when you look at the scientific literature, you know, ideally, I think you'd want something a little bit wider than that, so that animals feel comfortable. They don't want to have to cross, you know, something that feels like a catwalk necessarily. And actually, you know, I talked to some road ecologists who were, you know, at the time, somewhat skeptical of that structure, you know, felt like maybe it was a little bit too long and skinny. But, you know, it's obviously been used very widely by animals. And, you know, in 2020, UDOT released a video, you know, showing deer, elk, moose, coyotes, even porcupines using this structure. And, you know, the video went quite viral all over the place on the internet, which was cool to see. And, you know, it's sort of interesting story about how different designs of wildlife crossings, you know, can be appropriate in different situations. So that's quite a famous structure, not only in Utah but really around the world.
Yeah, that is amazing. If you have a chance to, you know, it's worth it just to drive that stretch of road just to see that. You write that researchers in Idaho found that merely playing the rumble of traffic through speakers is enough to deter migrating birds. Are there you know, solutions there, mitigations there for the noise?
Yeah, you know, it's a difficult one. You know, certainly those noise barriers that you often see by the side of the highway, you know, those are somewhat effective, you know, very close to the highway locally, but, you know, they're not going to solve the problem at a truly large scale. And you know, there's not a great solution there. I mean, certainly electric vehicles will be much quieter than internal combustion vehicles. You know, you don't, their engines don't make any noise. So that's theoretically good. But, you know, the problem is that at highway speeds, you know, when you hear, you know, kind of the hiss of an interstate highway, you know, what you're hearing isn't the engine. It's really the tires on pavement. And, you know, tires have also gotten quieter over time, but, you know, there's still certainly, you know, a sonic impact there. And, you know, road noise pollution is really a difficult one to solve, I think, as a result. And you know, I think that one important thing to remember is that, you know, road noise pollution is, yes, it's, you know, certainly this big ecological problem, but it's also a huge public health problem as well. You know, there have been lots of studies showing that, you know, that chronic road noise pollution, you know, raises our stress levels, makes us more susceptible to heart disease and diabetes and stroke. I mean, it's literally taking years off of our lives. So, you know, road noise pollution is, yeah, it's both, I think it's both one of the great ecological problems of our time and also one of the great kind of unsung public health crises as well.
Of course, you say this isn't just a problem in the U.S., it's a problem worldwide, and there's we're embarking on a what's going to be an explosion of road construction. But I wonder if you'd talk about Brazil and the Anteater. There's an initiative there called, what is it, Anteaters and Highways? Tell me about this.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite chapters to report. And, you know, and there, you know, Brazil has, of course, this incredible suite of biodiversity, you know, giant anteaters and giant armadillos and, you know, jaguars and all kinds of creatures. And, you know, like many, you know, South American countries, you know, they have this rapidly growing road network as well. You know, many new highways are being built, you know, many existing dirt highways are being paved. And, you know, the impacts on wildlife are pretty serious and, you know, very concerning in such a biodiverse place. And there, you know, there's just this wonderful research project called Anteaters and Highways, as you mentioned, that I had the opportunity to visit a few years ago. And, you know, I think that's a cool project because, you know, we've been talking about how roads cause all of these different problems, from roadkill to barrier effects to chemical and sensory problems. And, you know, that project is really trying to account for that full diversity of ecological issues. So they're, you know, studying every aspect of anteaters, from roadkill rates to, you know, to taking tissue samples to, you know, determine how you know, all of the chemicals associated with roads are impacting their health. You know, they're even interviewing truck drivers to, you know, to figure out you know, whether some truck drivers are hitting anteaters on purpose because, you know, they're considered to be bad luck. So, you know, some truckers actually target. So it's just a kind of a cool study that is trying to account for that full spectrum of road impact. And, you know, it's just the most amazing animals. You know, they're so sort of bizarre and alien and, you know, beautiful in their own weird way. They're sort of like Star Wars characters, you know. And so it's just really a great pleasure to spend time in the company with giant anteaters.
You're kind of fading out a little bit again. Maybe you know, adjust your phone again. Yeah, the anteaters are fascinating. Just fascinating animals. Kind of a throwback to, you know, more ancient animals. There was you do write about you know, anteaters that have been, I guess, collared or they're monitored. And I guess what they learned from that was the ones that survived and the ones who didn't is it's better to be a timid anteater, but not too timid, I guess. If you're adventurous, you probably are going to get smushed on the road.
Right. You know, I think that's a trade-off that all wild animals who live around roads are making, right? If you're excessively brave and cross roads frequently, you know, your time on Earth is probably limited. And, you know, that project, those anteater biologists had lots of sad stories about, you know, about anteaters who, you know, lived near roads and crossed often. And, you know, and they just knew that those animals were, you know, they had a limited life expectancy. You know, and the same is true of, you know, our creatures as well. You know, I mean, if you have a you know, a mule deer or an elk who's constantly crossing roads, well, you know, that's probably that animal is probably not going to live for a very long time. But, you know, at the same time, you know, if you never cross roads, I mean, that's obviously problematic in its own way. You know, and there are lots of stories in the book of, you know, of animal populations that have become extremely inbred because, you know, they can't disperse out to look for new mates, you know, like mountain lions living near Los Angeles are kind of the classic example of this. You know, they're animals who are so surrounded by freeways that they never they never disperse out of their population, and as a result, you know, they end up, you know, mating with their own relatives, and you know they've become very inbred, and you know would likely be doomed without a wildlife crossing. So you know, there's this, again, this trade-off that animals are making all the time. You know, do you cross roads to access habitat and food and mates and risk death along the way, or you know, do you stay put, not cross the road, and you know, perhaps survive, but you know, maybe at a long-term cost to your population. And that's a difficult challenge for any creature to navigate, I think.
Let's take another brief break. We'll be back with a final segment with Ben Goldfarb, whose latest book is called Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have about 5 or 6 minutes left with Ben Goldfarb, author of the new book, Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. So, Ben Goldfarb, you write that although it's easy to denounce this problem, you say, I benefit from roads as much as anyone. You say, I eat avocados trucked from California, get pizza delivered to my doorstep, rely on America's marvel of highway system to reach friends in hospitals and airports. Of course, we all do, right? So how do you navigate that kind of conflict? We benefit greatly, but we're in a way contributing to this problem.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one, and, you know, and one that I think about a lot. And, you know, certainly I've killed animals on the road, and I regret it. But, you know, I also, as you say, use roads and kind of love driving too a little bit. I'm somewhat ashamed to admit. So, you know, it's a tough one. But ultimately, I think, you know, where I come down is that it's not necessarily the responsibility of individual drivers to solve this problem, right? You know, I always think about it in analogous ways to climate change, where, you know, for a long time, the environmental movement was very focused on individual behavior, you know, getting people to change their light bulbs. And, you know, after a while, environmentalists realized that, you know, changing light bulbs is not going to solve climate change, right? That the answer is not, you know, necessarily changing individual behavior. It's, you know, it's really changing infrastructure and, you know, sort of societal systems, you know, and to me, I mean, solving this problem is, you know, it's really the responsibility of you know, federal and state governments to, you know, to engineer roads that are safer for both humans and wild animals. You know, I think that one of the really telling counterexamples is in Brazil, you know, which we were talking about earlier. And there, you know, there's actually a law that if you hit an animal and damage your car, you know, the road operator is responsible for compensating you for that damage, because, you know, road collisions with animals are something that we know how to prevent, you know, using fences and wildlife crossings, and therefore it's, you know, the responsibility of the agencies to do that prevention. So to me, I think that's the solution, is, you know, is changing our infrastructure itself, not necessarily, you know, shaming people into driving less.
And I think this is going to take, as with any, you know, big problem, it's going to take political will, right? It's going to take pressure. There is a success story you write about. I think there were Highway 93 that you were talking about, I think it's in Montana. They were going to, I don't know if they're going to expand it, but they're at least going to refurbish it. And a couple of Native American tribes stepped up and said, we want to be consulted.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's that Highway 93 project in northern Montana that, you know, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai really influenced. And that, you know, that was, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, sort of the origins of my interest in road ecology was, you know, was visiting that project and really being inspired, you know, and those tribes have, you know, kind of a saying, which is that the road is a visitor. You know, it's instead of dominating the landscape, you know, it should just pass through the landscape in as kind of subtle and less catastrophic a way as possible. And I think that idea of, you know, of roads as kind of visiting our landscapes rather than dominating them is a really good way of thinking about how we might design infrastructure that's less deleterious.
Just a couple of minutes left. I was interested, your epilogue is, you call it the anthropause. You're talking about COVID-19 and the fact that, you know, we noticed a lot of things when we all stayed home for a while, right? What did we notice about road ecology?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, in those first couple of months after traffic stopped in the spring of 2020, you know, I mean, roadkill dramatically dried up, of course, because we weren't driving around hitting wild animals. And, you know, I mean, there are researchers who calculated that, you know, in its own tragic, perverse way, you know, those spring 2020 lockdowns, you know, saved the most animal lives, you know, since the creation of the national park system, basically, right? It was this huge benefit to wildlife, of course, at an enormous cost to human society. And, you know, there were other, you know, sort of more subtle impacts as well. You know, researchers studying sparrows in San Francisco found that, you know, without all of that traffic noise kind of masking their calls, you know, that those birds were able to sing at much sort of broader registers and sing more complicated, intricate songs and, you know, thus better attract females, presumably. So, you know, I think that just goes to show, you know, how dramatic a toll our roads take, but also how, you know, animals are really ready for, you know, for those road impacts to disappear. You know, they're just kind of waiting in the wings. You know, of course, you know, we would never wish another round of lockdowns on this planet. That's a terrible solution. But, you know, I think it just shows that there are things we can do, you know, like closing some roads, or, you know, decommissioning old Forest Service roads, or building more wildlife crossings. You know, the nature is still there waiting to take advantage of a more benign road network. Maybe there are ways of engineering that.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. The book is out, well worth the read. Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. The author is Ben Goldfarb, and you can find him at bengoldfarb.com. Ben Goldfarb, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Take care.